Gardening is so much fun, and dreaming about what you'll grow next season is a big part of that, especially when the mercury is dipping well below zero for days on end. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to have some fun today talking about how to use these winter months to plan for your best garden ever. Our guest is Milwaukee-based gardening expert Melinda Myers. Melinda always has great advice and tips on tools and techniques to help you succeed. And Melinda, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Judith. It's always fun, and this is a great day to think about gardening, I think.
It's about all that's going to get us through, isn't it?
Boy,
it's a challenging time of year, and, you know, I think that the cold and the snow settled in so early this year that, you know, I think it's going to make for an even longer down season, but you really make great use of that time. What process do you go through for planning your gardens during the winter?
I do a couple things. One is, a lot of you know, I recently moved, and we had to do some changes in where our drive was and, you know, some major things. So I didn't want to do a whole lot of gardening because I don't want to have to start a garden twice. I have a lot of soil prep.
Even so you, Melinda, you don't want to start a garden twice?
Well, I will, but not as much soil prep as I'm going to need on these babies. I'm in it for the long haul, and I think soil preparation is always a good idea. I do have to admit, I did start a small garden with a little straw bale, a little square foot, an area that I know will eventually be a garden, so it's a good investment of time. So I'm going to spend the winter, you know, I'm looking at my landscape as a whole, and then I'm developing some teaching photography edible gardens for a new project. And I'm trying to find the best spot to do that, from convenience, from ease. And I'm using graph paper, a little bit of CAD design, a ruler, sketches, and I'm old school. So I'm taking that paper to scale drawing, and I'm cutting out different garden shapes, and I'm putting them around so that I can decide, is that the best place sun-wise, soil-wise, view-wise, and access to water, me, and all the other conveniences. But I also like to use some of the software, and you've probably been perusing the internet, and there's tons of great planning tools out there now.
Are there any that you find really particularly useful, and especially any that are free?
A lot of free ones. Gardener Supply, if you go to their website, one is you'll see lots of wonderful things that you can purchase and use in your garden to make gardening easier and more beautiful, raised beds and things. But also, they have a great garden planning software, and you can do your beds. And it's fun because they have line drawings of cabbage and broccoli and tomatoes. And then you slide those icons into your plan, and you can make it, you know, a 4 foot wide, a 6 foot wide, an 8 foot wide, a 2 foot wide bed by whatever length you want. So it's a grid system.
Wow.
And it really helps because they kind of lay out, well, you can put this many radishes in that square foot and this many tomatoes. You know, you'll need that many square feet. So it's just a hit and drag and very easy. Territorial Seed Company, a great source for a lot of heirloom seeds, but they also have a nice planning tool, a little more sophisticated, so it's kind of on the other end, but both are free sites as well. Bonnie Plants has a garden planning, and they also have it by theme garden. So it's really kind of, here's what you could, how you could grow a salsa garden. Here's how you could grow, you know, a pepper garden. And so they kind of give you a plan to start with that you could either duplicate if you want more. You're going to make a lot of salsa or grow a lot more peppers, or you can do it the size they provide. So it's really, I was just surfing last week for some gardening software, and then there's also lots of apps out there as well. So if you are in the garden center because you planned a little late, you can also access that way too.
That's great. Wow. I assume that with the growing popularity of smartphones, that probably the apps are going to be exploding, and they'll be more and more and easier ones to use.
You bet. National Garden Bureau, if you go to their website, it's a nonprofit group that promotes gardening, just recently published information on some of the garden apps. And they had such a great response from people saying, well, we tried this one and we did this one. You might want to check that out as well, because some are a few things on selecting plants, which I think is very helpful, but also if you have disease problems, insect problems, you know, some tools that are available from universities as well as seed companies and garden communicators.
Talking with Melinda Myers, she's a Milwaukee-based garden expert and the author of more than 20 books, including the Minnesota and Wisconsin Getting Started Garden Guide. She's also the host of Melinda's Garden Moments, and we'd be happy to have you join the conversation as well. When do you start planning your garden, and are there any tricks or maybe computer programs or apps that you'd like to share for successful planning? We'd love to have you join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And as always, you can leave a question or comment or a garden photo. We'd love to see those nice green garden photos right about now on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Robin Cherry, our on-air producer today, will be happy to get all those messages into us. Well, Melinda, I'm guessing that, you know, it's really fun. I will be the first to admit I'm big on, ooh, shiny thing, and start playing with, you know, a new app or a new computer program. But I'm guessing an important step to look forward is actually to look backward and to assess what did well or not in our gardens last year. And do you have a system for keeping track of that kind of information, too?
You know, you can tell I'm the person that loves books, loves the catalogs, not only online, but the ones you hold in your hand. And I use a garden journal. And so I like to write down things, and I've got several different versions. I have a spiral-bound one that I use for several years. I have a notebook with page protectors that I can just slip the tags in because I don't know about you, but I'm usually thinking about it when I'm messy, dirty, and in the garden.
Yep.
So that allows me to save those tags with all the information on it. Computers are great. That's on my list of things to do because you can keep adding years and years of information. I think the key to success, and I'd be curious to find out what you do, Judith, but is whatever inspires you to record the information and is accessible for you to reach. So if you're a computer person and you like to, you have digital photos and you want to include those, you know, maybe the computer's the place. If you like to sit with a cup of coffee looking out the window dreaming of your garden with pen in hand, maybe you just want a beautiful notebook that you can share. So I think it's really, for me, the tool is about what inspires me to write and keeps me writing. Because you always, I think we all start out pretty good in January and February, March, as we start planting. Sometimes it's, you know, gets less and less often. And so I think anytime you can do that. I also like to use weather calendars, whether it's your local Audubon Society, your local TV station, the Master Gardeners providing, you know, interesting weather, you know, the drought of 2012, we had a flood, because those things end up impacting our garden for years to come. So it's very fun to have a record of that. Oh, yeah, that's why this is happening in my garden. And it's a great way to let someone else do some of that work for you.
Well, and I think it's also good to remind ourselves what quote unquote normal weather is, because we've had a few years where it has not been normal. You know, 2 years ago with the huge drought, and it was so warm in March and then cooler in April, which felt really cold but was probably still above average. But I think, as you said, those weather calendars or those phenology calendars are really a great tool to remind us, well, you know, it might not be exactly on, you know, this date this year, but usually this time of year in my neck of the woods, this is what it's going to be.
Exactly, exactly. And it's just, you know, because the time passes quickly, I'm sounding like some of my old aunts that I swore I'd never be. But, you know, time does pass. And then you go, oh, I wish I would have, I should have, you know, done this at that time so I would be harvesting, or to prevent pest problems, I should have been monitoring earlier. You know, Phil Pelletieri gave great advice when I was in Extension years ago, and he said, mark your calendar. When you have a pest problem, mark next year's calendar a few weeks earlier. So then you start watching for those pests. You may not have them, so you may not have to do anything, but if you watch for them and you know, get those aphids under control when there's 20 versus a few hundred, a strong blast of water may be enough so that you can really reduce your workload. It reminds you to watch for them. And again, you may not have the problem next year, but it reminds you to watch for, continually monitor, and keep an eye out for those pests that may, you know, cause big problems if they're not controlled eco-friendly is good, especially when the populations are small. So we want to get them early so we can have less work and better results.
That's a great tip because that actually allows us to do maybe not prevention, but really early intervention instead of, yeah, suddenly saying, I can't even see the garage because there are so many box elder bugs on it.
Yes.
Well, what you mentioned seed catalogs, and those are certainly starting to show up in the mail now. What's the best way that you like to use them other than just that enjoyment and entertainment of flipping through them?
Well, one of the things is, you know, it is a great source of information. We always need to remember that the catalog companies put out their best pictures, so they don't always look that great in our gardens. So read the information to make sure those plants are going to match. I like to use my old catalog. So as a new one comes in, I grab the old one, throw it in a pile, and when I do workshops with kids, we do garden planning. Or I'm planning on doing that with my grandkids this year. Give them a chunk of soil out, and I have space now, and let them plan their garden. And so have them cut out pictures or get out the crayons and the paper. And, you know, that gives them a visual of what they can grow. Might get them excited. If nothing else, it gets us talking gardening and gets them excited about something that I have a passion for. And I think as a grandparent, an aunt, a parent, you know, if you can inspire kids, I think that's a huge thing. And so those old catalogs are great for that reason. So it's one step before they go to the recycle bin.
Well, and of course, you know, all the advice is to limit screen time and, you know, get kids doing other things. But that having been said, there are a few things that get kids more excited about something that they think that they might not be excited about than being able to do it on a computer. And it sounds like some of those apps and software programs that you mentioned, Melinda, would almost have the feel of, you know, kind of a video game like The Sims or something like that.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I think more and more of us are trying to find ways to involve kids. And one of the things I find is they're usually more adept at those software programs than some of us. And so they may also not only enjoy dragging the line drawings and putting together a garden and changing things out, but showing mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, aunt, or uncle how to do it.
Right,
so,
right.
There's and, that added benefit.
And I'm guessing some of our listeners might be saying, that's exactly what I need, is a little mentor who can help me with this. And what a great project to do together. It's not just saying, here's this program, you know, go sit on the computer. But, you know, hey, let's, you know, how about that garden plot in the back of my yard? You want to help me plan that out? And it could be a really fun family project.
And, you know, one of the things I like to do when I work with kids is, if possible, have some of the produce. You obviously have to buy it at the grocery store now, but fix a meal, eat it, and then start doing the planning. You know, I do that with sprouts and microgreens a lot. Quick results, you know, if they can eat it, then they plant it. It's really a fun activity. Well, as they're planning, you know, what's broccoli, what's cauliflower, what's cabbage? You know, if you haven't served it regularly, mm-hmm. if you're not familiar with it, it might be fun to have it in a salad or, you know, eat some with a dip so that you're combining food, nutrition, and gardening and a fun activity. Food always makes everything more enjoyable, I think.
Well, and it can be a little cooking lesson, too, at the same time.
Exactly.
We're talking with Melinda Myers today on Garden Talk. She is a Milwaukee-based gardening expert and the author of more than 20 wonderful books, including the Minnesota and Wisconsin Getting Started Garden Guide. She's also the host of Melinda's Garden Moments, and we always appreciate when she spends time with us on Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we are visiting with Melinda Myers, Milwaukee-based gardening expert with lots of great ideas for planning for our best garden yet and what to do when it's in and what we can start indoors and a whole lot more. And you can join in the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, Melinda, as I was saying earlier, you know, the cold and the snow really settled in early this year. And so I think it throws us off a little mentally about where we're at in the leading up to garden season. When is it a good time to start thinking about starting seeds indoors? I know if you do it too early, then you end up with spindly little seedlings. But, you know, are we going to be able to start playing in the dirt at least inside soon?
You bet. One of the things I mentioned sprouts and microgreens earlier. That's a great year-round way to get your hands in the soil or the seed starting mix or just with a jar and sprouts, and you get quick results and some greenery. So that you can do year-round. For vegetables, we want to wait till the end of February to start our onions, and then we get into March with our cool crops, the middle of March for cabbage and broccoli and things that we're growing, transplants of cool weather plants. Now, flowers, you want to check the back of the seed packet. Pansies will be starting in April, or in March, I'm sorry, if you want to move them out as soon as the worst of winter passes. You know, if you do geraniums, begonias, especially those growing begonias, good job, because they're teeny tiny seeds. You know, you're going to start pretty soon with those in February again. So check the seed packet, because it'll count backwards from the time of the last scheduled frost in our area. You know, Memorial Day is a good place to start for warm season plants early June if you're in the far north. It's going to get here sooner than we think. But then count backwards so that it'll tell you, you know, from the last scheduled frost, you know, when do you start them outside? So that's a good way. And making a seed starting calendar, whether it's on your regular calendar, on your web-based calendar, is a good thing to do. Okay, so you pull out all the seeds that you want to start, check the packets. In my book, I talk about the date. The Extension Service has some good information also. And then start writing on your calendar. This is the week to do onions. This is the week I'm going to start my pansies. This is the week. And that will help you keep track of it. So you spend, you know, a good cold day like today looking at those seed packets and start doing that outline, because that's going to make your job easier. You know, if you're like me, I have seeds left from the past I keep in the refrigerator, and so they're in good shape to start again. Order up new things, visit your local garden center, and that's a good way to find out what do you have, what do you need, and when do you need to start them inside. And this is also a great time to gather a good seed starting mix. If you're growing under anything under lights, to do that. That's a great way to prepare. And then I have herbs growing. I just bought a light setup for my basement and for starting seeds, but also for growing some herbs in the winter, because just get that little bit of extra light makes a huge difference. So I can harvest chives. I've got some parsley. My rosemary is alive and blooming.
Nice.
So that's a fun thing you can do. Or in a sunny window. If you don't want to do artificial lights, get a few pots of herbs, put them in a sunny window, and enjoy them. It'll be amazing that just that little bit of gardening makes you feel better and makes your dishes taste a little better, too.
Well, as you said, we're a little early for starting anything that we would actually be transplanting outdoors after. But let's talk a little more specifically about that setup. I mean, you put some terms out there and some items, but for people who have never done it before, it might feel a little intimidating. So when you talk about the potting mix, what kind of potting mix or what kind of seed starting mix are we going to use to start those seeds indoors?
Great question. You want to find a well-drained potting mix, a brand that you really have had success with, or try a few different types. I like to add my own fertilizer and do all the amending myself. So I just look for one that I've had good success with, and there are several excellent brands out there. Seed starting mixes are mostly vermiculite and a little bit of peat moss, and those are much lighter. They tend to have less opportunity for disease organisms to develop and for soggy, water-soaked soil that ends up rotting seeds. So seed starting mix will give you a little added benefit. So that might be a good thing to start with. You need to put it in something. Now, you can buy flats and sell packs. You can make your own. I have a little pot maker that you just take strips of newspaper, wrap it around a dowel rod. You can make your own, but it's probably about 2 inches in diameter. Roll the paper, smash the bottom, set those in some type of container like a flat, and I can fill those. Once the plants are full size, ready to move outside and the weather's good, I can just transplant directly and the newspaper disintegrates.
Actually, when we talked about gardening gifts before the holidays with Astrid Neuenhaus, that's always one of her favorites. And she said that that's also a really good way to get kids involved, is that, you know, it's a really, even pretty small kids can handle the little dowel that you use. And it's a really fun little project.
It is, and there's also on our website under the Kids Gardening, for those that want to go one step further, you can do the origami newspaper pot.
Oh.
And that's definitely, if you've done origami, you just have to have faith that those folds that don't look like they'll work will really result in a pot. And there are also some other instructions from other websites, too. But that's kind of fun, too. So maybe for older kids or adults that want a little more of a challenge, you can do the origami. I'm huge on recycling. So if you eat yogurt, you know, every day, punch a hole in those containers. Applesauce, if the little kids eat their applesauce or mandarin oranges, or you may take in your lunch. Fast food dishes, containers for salads, those make great seed starting. And we're reusing, so we get a second life out of something before it gets recycled. And I think it teaches a valuable lesson, and it saves you some money, too.
Talking with Melinda Myers about all kinds of things that we can do to get ready for gardening. Right now, in the middle of winter, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, and we'd love to have you join in. Do you start seeds yourself? What kind of seeds have you had good luck with? And what kind of setup do you have? What would you recommend for the size and scale and materials that you use? We'd love to have you share your experiences or ask Melinda a question at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Now, Melinda, when we do start starting those seeds, do you cover them to keep moisture in, like with saran wrap or something, or are they just kind of sitting there in the little potting mix and in those little cups?
Great question. We want to make sure that potting mix, that seed starting mix, is moist but not soggy. If you cover it, some people like to use wet newspaper to cover all their flats or containers. Some will use plastic. I like to use kind of a loose sheet of plastic so that I don't seal in too much and get it too wet. The salad containers for fast food are great because they're like a little mini greenhouse. Flip the lid shut.
Oh, that's a great idea, yeah.
You know, so you're right. If you can hold the moisture in, less work for you. Keeping that potting mix, that seed starting mix, consistently moist. Check the packet of seed starting mix to see what kind of fertilizer, if any, was included. You want to get those seedlings up. Once they have a couple of sets of leaves that look like the miniatures of the plant, you may need to use a dilute solution of fertilizer. Because most of those mixes, if they don't have a fertilizer added, you'll need to do a little bit. But do less, very dilute, because you can always add more, but you can't take it away.
And do you water with a spray bottle, or how do you water? Because it seems like if you're really trying to keep it moist but not too wet, it would be easy to overwater.
You bet. I have this really fun eco spout that looks like a miniature watering can nozzle that I put on a milk jug, so it breaks it up so it's very fine once those seedlings are up. When they're little, a spray bottle and then keeping that plastic on top works great because you're right, it's easy to wash out the seeds, the last thing you want to do. So either a spray bottle, but once those seedlings are up and growing, you want to make sure you get that whole seed starting mix moist. And so then you might want to move to a watering can, but one with some type of water breaker so that you're not washing out the seeds, but a very gentle stream once those seedlings are up and growing. And I mentioned artificial lights. You don't have to, but artificial lights do help because the gray days of winter in Wisconsin make it tough. And keeping your lights on for about 14, no more than 16 hours a day, 4 inches above the top of your seedlings will really be great. Now, the other thing I forgot to mention is warmth. Most seeds need warm temperatures to sprout. And so, you know, if you start them in the basement, it's pretty cool in my basement. Mm-hmm. So I usually start my seeds upstairs. They don't need light. I find a warm spot in the house, you know, the warmest spot you can find in the house. Then once they sprout, you know, there are some people that put curtains around their light setups to hold the warmth in. If you use any artificial heat, make sure that it's set for seed starting. If you put it on a mat, it needs to be a heating mat made for starting seeds, not one that you would use on yourself because water's involved and you don't want to burn yourself. You want to do that carefully.
Well, we have a couple people who'd like to join the conversation,
great.
So let's go to the phones. And Harry in Manitowoc is up first. Hi, Harry.
Hi, I think you just answered my question. I had started seeds before, but it appeared as though because my basement wasn't heated that they started, but then they didn't do very well, and I was wondering about the soil being too cool.
Yes, you're right. And temperatures for seedlings, most of them germinate the best in the high 60s and low 70s. Your seed packet will often tell you. Once they get up and growing, you know, if you can keep them 65 to 70 degrees, you're going to have much better success. My basement right now is really cool, so I'm going to have to do a little work making sure I keep those nice and warm to get things growing once I start my seed. So, yes, warmth is really one of the issues. Light is one of the issues, and moisture. So you're right on target there, Harry. Need to find a little bit more.
Okay.
Thanks, Harry. So seeds, for the most part, don't – well, do all seeds not need light, or are there some that really do need some exposure to light in order to even germinate?
I'm glad you asked that question. Lettuce is one example of seeds that need light. A lot of your very fine seeds, when you read the packet, it'll just say, you know, place on the soil surface and then just lightly, you know, just lightly rake the soil with your fingers or a fork just to barely cover the seed. So the finer the seed, the closer to the surface. So some seeds do need light. Usually ambient light in the house is sufficient, or a good sunny window. But most seeds do well, don't need the light. So that's a great question. So some you do need to have them in a bright spot to get them to sprout.
And why don't you repeat, Melinda, how many hours a day we should have those grow lights on?
You know, 14 is ideal. No, 16 won't do any much. Anything more than 16 won't really do any good. So sometime between 14 and 16. Now, with artificial lights, you can get a plant light, a grow light, and that has the full spectrum of light, so not only for growing, but if you're trying to grow, say, African violets and getting them to bloom. If you use a cool and a warm light, that'll give you the full spectrum also. There are some new LED lights that are full spectrum sunlight types that are better energy, more efficient at energy, and less of an issue you know, with energy consumption, still give you the wavelengths you need, the light you need, but they're very expensive. Mm. So I think the good news is we're seeing some energy efficiency coming into this market. So for a lot of people, fluorescence may be your best option at this point, but you might want to keep an eye out for some changes in the near future.
I think Miranda in Carleton actually has something related to that. So let's go there. Hi, Miranda.
Hi. Mostly covered what I was going to ask, but I guess my question is the difference between the actual grow lights, fluorescents, other ones. I have 4-foot ballasts that I use just on some industrial shelving, and I've just been putting plain old fluorescents in them, but then somebody said I need to change them every year, and I don't know if that's true or if I could carry them over.
Hmm. Did they say why you had to change them?
That they just they aren't as effective, which doesn't make sense to me. If they function, it seems that they should be effective.
Right.
They turn on.
Have you ever heard that, Melinda?
You know, I think sometimes we all things get translated. It's that game telephone. And as long as you're getting good growth, I'd let your plants decide on if you're still getting efficient energy. One growing season doesn't seem sufficient to really reduce the amount of light that's been. That the fluorescents are giving off. So I would just grow, unless you're having some problem with them, I would continue to do it. Sounds like you've got the perfect setup, that you've got the fluorescent tubes that'll work just fine. On my website, under Melinda's Garden Moment audio tips, I did something on selecting artificial lights for the indoor garden. So if at the end of the show you go, what was that she said? And I talk about the full spectrum compact fluorescents, the LEDs as well. And so, you know, that's one way to do that. So if you do that combination, what we're looking for is blue light promotes leaf and stem growth. It's the red light that promotes flowering and bud development. So if you're using cool lights, you're fine for starting seedlings. Cool and warm will give you for flowering plants. So I would continue doing what you're doing. If your plants aren't responding well, then that's when you'll want to look at changing them out. But I would, you know, I wouldn't automatically change them out every year. Plus, that's something we don't want to throw in the landfill if we don't have to.
I was just going to say, yeah, ecologically, it's probably not the best solution either.
Yes, and that is fluorescent tubes, as you probably know, but for everybody else, need to go. Most communities put those in the household hazardous waste. You don't throw those directly outside. Most communities will help you with the recycling of those.
talking with Melinda Myers, who is a Milwaukee-based gardening expert and the author of more than 20 books, including The Minnesota and Wisconsin Getting Started Garden Guide. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk, and we'd love to have you join the conversation. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Did you have some things in your garden that went really well last year with flowers, with vegetables, anything else? Or maybe you're looking to add some new varieties this year. Melinda would be happy to help. Please join in. Spring is really not that far off, is it, Melinda? It feels like it today.
It feels like it.
Exactly.
But it really is going to be here sooner, and I think we'll all be really ready too.
I think so too. Well, Jerry in Rhinelander is up next, so let's go there. Hi, Jerry.
Hi there. Glad to listen to your show.
Thanks so much.
Last couple of years, I have been growing my own seeds, mainly tomato plants. And this past year, I did like 35 bales of straw bale gardening. And my problem with seeds is that I've been able to plant them, and they've been growing in the garden and such. But I want them to look better and stronger than what I have. You know, they sometimes look pretty spiny or weak. And I use the seed mat for the warmth. I do use some grow lights and such. I even use a fan to try to keep some movement to get the stem to be stronger. Hmm. Is there anything else?
Boy, you're really doing it. And I'm glad you mentioned the fan. There's been some research that showed when plants move, it helps to build the girth of their stems, so they get thicker and stouter. So many gardeners will do exactly what you're doing, Jerry, and have a fan just on very lightly to get some movement just that would happen out in the garden. Now, are your seedlings, once they're outside, do they catch up and get growing, or do they look kind of weaker than transplants all season long?
No, they catch up really well and really strong. I lose probably less than 5% of my plants.
Excellent.
And such. I'm just wondering if I'm not planting the seed not deep enough so they come out too spiny too easily.
No, well, one of the things in general with seeds, we plant them about twice their diameter deep. Keeping your lights 4 to 6 inches above the top of the transplant. So you said you were using artificial lights, grow lights, so keeping them close. That may be they're too far away, so that's one option. What kind of fertilizing are you doing?
I use, what do you call that, Miracle-Gro. I use that very lightly.
Okay, every week?
Like every other watering.
Every other watering, okay. And you're using like a seed starting mix?
Yes.
When do you? What time of year do you start? About.
I start right around mid-March.
You might want to back that up to the end. They've done some research, and with tomatoes and peppers, we're finding starting them in early April. Believe it or not, they're indoors for a shorter period, and they tend to be a little stouter. So you might want to start them a couple weeks later, and see if that helps. It sounds like you're doing everything else exactly right, and even mid-March isn't too off the mark, but you might want to give it a little bit later start and see if that helps, because there'll be less time indoors, easier to adjust to the outside, and probably take off a little faster for you.
Well, I do the straw bale gardening, so
okay,
this year I hope to get a bigger a start a lot sooner than last year, being
okay.
That there was like 3 foot of snow drift all around my place, so...
I'm sorry to laugh.
It's all hidden in mid-April.
Right.
And you bring up a good point, Jerry, and I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, I'm giving dates for if you're not doing the extra work like Jerry is, but I'm a huge fan of using floating row covers to jumpstart my season. They're fabrics that let air, light, and water through. You lightly drape them over the soil, anchor them on the edges. As the plants grow, they hold that heat in around the plants, but they let air, light, and water through. And even if I start my tomatoes outside at the normal planting time, I'll often cover them with these floating row covers, because what I find is often our June nights are really cool. And so if I can keep them a little toastier and warm that first month, boy, they take off, and I'm harvesting several weeks earlier without even planting sooner. So you're right, Harry. If you're planting them out earlier and you're warming up the soil, or in your case the straw bales, and you're protecting them from the cool air temperatures, then mid-March should be fine. So it sounds like you're doing everything right, and just check the light and see if that helps.
And Jerry, you said you did 35 straw bales?
Yes, I did.
Wow. And were you successful? Would you do it again?
Yes, I've even turned on quite a few people, bought the book for others, and they're all excited to do it this year.
Wow. Well, that's in 35 fact, is quite a plantation you've got going there.
Yeah, it was quite the jungle, and I even turned on a school system that they actually did that last year, that I went and did 3 bales at a school for a daycare, and the kids planted them and took care of them, and I had a great time with that. So
that's a great, Jerry, thanks for mentioning that, because if you don't have kids in your life or your kids don't live close by, getting daycare and elementary school kids excited about gardening is great. And, you know, straw bale gets it at a good height for them, and it's a little bit of a different, unique method that gets their attention, too. Great idea.
Thanks so much, Jerry.
Yeah, you bet. Can I have one more question?
Sure.
That your talk about this roll cover, what I use is a clear plastic. Mm-hmm. I do keep them away from the plant, only because one of two things is that I don't know where to get this roll cover. And, of course, you know, money's isn't always really well with me. So I'm wondering, you know, the price versus the clear plastic, is that okay or not?
Good question. I'm kind of a low-maintenance gardener. So one of the things I like about the floating row covers is they require no construction because you don't have to keep them. The plants elevate them. I reuse it as long as it's not ripped. So usually what happens is I start with a big piece and every year it gets smaller and smaller and until, you know, it's too small to meet my needs, and then I reinvest. I'm trying to think anywhere from, you can get wide, like 20 by 20 foot pieces, and I think they were like $9.99 or $6.99. They do come in rolls. I tend to do square foot wide row gardening. So I like the big squares versus the, I think they're 3 foot wide, when you can also get 5 foot wide rolls. Many garden centers carry them. Garden supply companies like Gardener Supply and some others also carry them. And plastic works fine. I'm kind of low input, so ventilating is an issue sometimes, making sure that it doesn't get too hot, making sure that I remember to water even if it's rained outside, that type of thing. So it's just another tool that you can use. Plastic, that whole tunnel method works great. It's just a different kind of care and maintenance. So you bring up a good point. When you're starting plants from seeds or growing gardens, you know, there's a lot of ways to be successful, and matching it to your garden style as well as your budget is really important.
Thanks a lot, Jerry. And just to go back for a second, Melinda, when Jerry was talking about putting that fan on to help kind of toughen up those stems, that's part of what we often call hardening off when we kind of transition those seedlings to the outdoors, right?
Well, actually, it's during the growing process indoors, believe it or not.
Oh, okay.
You know, you mentioned hardening off, and I forgot to mention that, so thanks for bringing that up, Judith, is that period from when they go from under the artificial lights or in a greenhouse, if you're that lucky, out to the garden, you need to toughen up those plants. So you let them go slightly drier when you're moving them outside. You slowly introduce them to the light so they don't go from under the artificial lights into the full sun location. Start in the shade, give them a little direct sun the first day, more the second, more the third. Stop fertilizing till you put them in the garden. And in 1 to 2 weeks, they'll be ready to go in the garden. If you go direct from under lights to full sun, that's where you get white, bleached out marks on your plant, stunting, sometimes can even kill some of those delicate plants. So that hardening off is a very important issue.
Talking with Melinda Myers. Melinda is a Milwaukee-based gardening expert and the author of more than 20 books, including The Minnesota and Wisconsin Getting Started Garden Guide. She's also the host of Melinda's Garden Moments, and we're always happy to have her with us on Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Robin Cherry, our on-air producer today on the Ideas Network. we are talking with garden expert Melinda Myers about what we can be doing in the winter and what we can look forward to in the spring and summer. And Melinda, let's go back to the phones and Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota. Hi, Pam.
Hi. So nice to talk to you. I love to watch you on TV or hear you whenever you're on. I started an avocado seed. I've tried several times and didn't have success, but it's sprouted now. It's about 8 inches tall. And kind of like the amaryllis, it's supposed to be kept outside of the soil. But now that it's that big, I was wondering, as I move it into larger pots, does it need to be buried deeper or not?
You can keep it with that top portion at, you know, the point of the avocado, even with the soil surface, or just slightly above. So once you're ready to move it into a container of potting mix, it's okay to bury that seed. Not a problem, but leave the stem out. And then a well-drained potting mix, and keep it relatively pot-bound. You know, you don't want to go huge. I think sometimes we go, I'm going to put it in a big pot, then I'll never have to transplant for 5 years. But what happens is the plant spends a lot of energy putting down roots instead of top growth. And the other problem happens is we've got a lot of soil or potting mix, very few roots, that's more likely to have root rot because that potting mix stays wet longer. We don't have the roots to take up that moisture, and so it leads to root rot more frequently. So, you know, just a, you know, bigger than the root ball, slightly bigger than the root ball, well-drained potting mix and a container with drainage holes. And good job. You know, you bring up a fun thing, Pam, for gardeners of all ages is starting plants from kitchen scraps. You know, it's great with kids. I have a sweet potato growing in my basement under lights because mine sprouted in the pantry. And, you know, I hadn't done it for a while, and I needed it for a garden web tip. I thought, well, I'll take some pictures, and I planted it, and it started growing. So how can you throw it away, right?
Right.
So it is a lot of fun. So that's another fun thing to do, whether it's an avocado, grapefruit seeds, you know. That's not where you grow things for big productivity, but it's a fun thing to do this time of year, really any time of the year.
I've also seen floating around on social media, especially, I think, that you can plant or root, at least, the top of a pineapple or even the bottom of a stalk of celery.
Yes, and I haven't done the celery. That's on my list. I have celery in there. Once I make my dish, I'm going to do the planting of the bottom. The pineapples are fun. If you've grown bromeliads, and they're wonderful relatives of pineapples, they're epiphytes. So they grow naturally in rainforest on trees. They're not parasitic. They just live in the canopy of trees and capture their nutrients from rainfall and leaf litter. Well, pineapples are a type of bromeliad. So when that parent plant, you take that top, start it, get it growing. Once it fills that container and it reaches full size, you know, good size plant, put it in a plastic bag with a slice of apple. The apple gives off ethylene, encourages blooming. So you do that for 3 days, take it out. Hopefully you'll get flowers and a miniature pineapple forming on your plant. So a lot of fun.
Wow. And I just did a quick Google search here saying sprout vegetable scraps. And boy, there is a lot of information out there about well over a dozen different things that you can grow. So that, you know, whether anything really comes of it or not, what a fun thing to do with kids to show them the process of how plants start.
Well, and it's a good way to rationalize why those potatoes are growing in your
pantry. It was intentional. It was intentional.
Right.
Now, when you said you sprout sweet potatoes, I know that sweet potato vines have become really popular in container planting and in window boxes. Is that the same thing that you get when you have a sweet potato that just happens to sprout?
Yes. The sweet potato, the ornamental varieties, are just cultivars of the edible sweet potato. So they've been selected for their beautiful foliage. Some will even bloom in a long growing season here in Wisconsin. And then the sweet potato that's edible is one that's not bred for such beautiful foliage. The leaves are heart-shaped and green and pretty. And so you'll get sweet potatoes forming, tuberous roots forming in both the edible as well as the vining ornamental type. Not as tasty. I know some gardeners have tried that at the end of the season. When they're cleaning out their garden, they'll dig up their ornamental sweet potato vine, and they'll find all these tuberous roots. Safe to eat, usually not real tasty.
Safe doesn't mean necessarily delicious.
That's right. Some gardeners will even save those tuberous roots over winter and start them again in spring. What I find is not real consistent results.
Taking cuttings before the frost kills the top is a great way if you want to overwinter the ornamental sweet potatoes for enjoyment indoors in your home or to have some plants for outdoors in the garden.
Talking with Melinda Myers about gardening, and you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. And Melinda, we had a post on the Facebook page going back to that topic that we started with about planning out a garden and different tools there are. And Jannie says that she uses a site called A Garden for the House. And the person that does that site suggests something called winter sowing. She says it's amazing because you plant now in jugs, put them outside, and it frees up your home space. And so that site is A Garden for the House. So maybe another one to check out.
It sounds like a plan. And I think anything, I love working with Midwest and Northern Midwest gardeners because we are a hardy group and get very creative.
I was going to say creative out of necessity, right?
Exactly.
Well, let's go back to the phones and Judy on Madeline Island. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm changing the subject a little bit.
Sure.
Oh,
that's
okay. I have a question about making some fairy gardens that I would like to give as gifts in the spring. And I thought it would be kind of a good idea to do it sometime in the winter, just for a winter project. I've done one with a disabled granddaughter at Christmas time, and it was delightful. But I'm curious about the soil that I need to put, you know, to start with. Do I need to put rocks on the bottom? Do I need to put charcoal in somewhere to keep it from getting too acid? What do I need for soil?
Sure. And Melinda, why don't you start out by describing what a fairy garden is?
Fairy gardens are basically small miniature gardens, and the idea is they're the places where fairies inhabit. And so they become quite a fun way to garden. So people put miniature houses either that they purchase or make, or furniture and small fairies, and great for kids. So it's about adding a little mystery. And if you know, I recently chatted with someone about the trend of fairy gardening. It's been around for a few years, still pretty popular, and they said, I don't like fairy gardens. I'm like, well, then do a miniature garden, because that's the same idea. Just leave the fairies out if you're not a fan. But for kids and adults, because I find a lot of adults enjoying fairy gardens as well. What are you growing the fairy garden in?
Well, that's my next question.
Oh, okay.
I was thinking about like a deep saucer, you know, like a plastic saucer for a pot. But I could use anything. I mean, I could use an old enamel pan or
right,
whatever.
The reason I ask, because you bring up some good point, drainage is critical. So a lot of people use troughs with drainage holes, but then you need a saucer underneath them if you're
right,
starting them indoors. If you use tin or metal, I always like to punch holes in the bottom just because if you put it outside and we get a rainy period, there's
mm-hmm,
nothing you can do. So if you have drainage holes, it forgives you if you overwater, and if it's too wet, you know, it'll really increase success. So if you can have something with drainage holes, you don't need rocks, and you won't really need the charcoal either. Rocks and charcoal are for closed containers, and you still need to be careful. So if you have no drainage holes, the problem with rocks, you put rocks in the bottom, on top, and it gets wet, and then it's still, the soil gets wet. It just gives you a little bit of insurance.
Make sure I have drainage holes.
Yeah, I saw a really cool fairy garden done in a Weber grill, and they even had a mini Weber grill on the fairy garden. So
that's adorable.
Funny. Yeah, so there's really fun things you can do. So a well-drained potting mix, a container, if possible, with drainage holes, something to protect the furniture or tabletop underneath. And what you even may want to do is start – so are you thinking of doing – plants from seeds or taking cuttings or?
No, I have a pretty big chunk of baby tears.
Oh, okay.
And then I do have a garden center near me that they just have little plants for fairy gardens and, you know, miniature gardens. So I'm not planning to use seeds.
Okay. And then it sounds like you've done this before. So but for people who haven't, looking for plants that require the same light and growing conditions, you're using a lot of indoor plants, which are great. So you could have your fairy garden in the house, maybe move it out to a sheltered spot in the summer, back in the winter, or if you've got a good sunny window, indoors all year. And then the key for fairy gardens or miniature gardens are finding plants that you can either trim and keep down to size so they look like miniature trees, ground covers. Baby tears, excellent as a ground cover. Some of the irisine, alternathera, the colorful leaf plants, I've seen trimmed into little shrubs. Some of the miniature sedums work nice for drier growing conditions. So, you know, that's great. More and more garden centers are carrying miniature plants, so that's another place to, what I like to do is I like to go find my container, bring it with me, and then go to the garden center and start placing plants just to see how they look together. And it's sometimes easy if you bring the container with you. Most garden centers are cool with that, or if you buy one there. And then you can find out, is it going to fit? Is it going to look okay?
And so you're really doing that process like we did planning the outdoor garden. Well, Melinda Myers is a Milwaukee-based garden expert and the author of more than 20 gardening books. You can find her online at melindamyers.com, and Myers is M-Y-E-R-S. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. And this is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Melinda Myers for joining us today. She is a Milwaukee-based gardening expert and the author of more than 20 books, including the Minnesota and Wisconsin Getting Started Garden Guide. She's also the host of Melinda's Garden Moments, and she's always a lot of fun to talk to. And Melinda, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Oh, always a pleasure, Judith.
Well, let's go right back to the phone and Nancy in Milwaukee, who's been holding on for a bit. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a small yard which has roses, shrubs, and then some perennials like echinacea. And I'm wondering, sometimes I use chemical fertilizer, sometimes I've used organic. And I'm wondering if it makes a difference, if it's better to use the organic for the sake of the soil.
You know, the benefit of organic fertilizer is the whole act that the microorganisms, what happens in the soil because of the activity of the microorganisms is helpful. And the other benefit is it's most organics are slow release. So you give a little bit of nutrient over a long period of time instead of a big push. It all ends up being in the same chemical form that the plants need to take it up. It's just the process of making it available. Now, with cooler temperatures, sometimes doing a inorganic fertilizer, maybe doing a solution for quick hit when the soils are cool and the microorganisms aren't really active can be helpful. I think most of you know I'm a huge fan of Milorganite, which is a low nitrogen. It's an organic nitrogen fertilizer. And I like it because it gives me that goof-proof benefit. So that's another thing for organics. It's really hard to over-fertilize. Not that you should ever over-fertilize, but, you know, whoops, I forgot, or I just a little bit extra on that end of the row. It's a little more forgiving. The other thing with roses, shrubs, perennials, if your soil's in good shape, you don't need to fertilize a lot. So if you were able to work that soil when you planted, say your perennials, you added good organic matter and worked it up. If you use organic mulches, shredded leaves, leaf mold, compost every year, every other year on your perennials, you probably don't need to do much fertilizing. And with shrubs, and roses tend to be a little heavier feeding, so you're going to probably need to give them a little bit of nutrient. Shrub roses, I find, when I have good soil and I use organic mulches, very little fertilizer needed. So one of the things that you may want to do, it's a little early to go out and do soil testing since we can't even see it right now, but this spring before you get started or as you get started planting but before you fertilize, a soil test is a good way to find out what nutrients your soil has and what you need to add. And so if you're not sure, if you feel like your plants need a nutrient boost and you're not sure, you might want to start with a soil test. If things are looking good and you did good soil prep and you mulch with organic materials, let your plant's growth rate and leaf color be your guide in terms of nutrient needs and fertilizer. I tend to be a fan of organic fertilizers just because as those microorganisms work on breaking it down so that it's in a form available to the plants, then I find that it's, you know, you get some other side benefits, soil improvement, slow release, that type of thing.
Oh, thank you. May I ask one more question?
Sure. Go ahead, Nancy.
Is milorganite what you would use on the shrubs, et cetera? We've used it on our grass, but I have not put it on shrubs. I mean, if it does need fertilizing.
Yeah. You know, milorganite's good for any, it's a general all-purpose, as many organics are, so it's an all-purpose fertilizer for trees, shrubs, lawns, fruits, vegetables, those kind of things, too. So that's another option, too. So it's an organic nitrogen fertilizer, but there are others out there as well. So you want to pick something that meets your gardening needs. I just find it's easy. It comes in a bag. It's easy to spread. And I'm all about easy.
Well,
good results.
Thanks for that call, Nancy. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to talk@WPR.org or post a question or a comment or a garden photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show. And Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And actually, Melinda, we did have a comment from Kyle on the Facebook page. He says, I'd love to garden again, but I live in a small apartment now. I am guessing, Melinda, that you would say that that's not necessarily the end of Kyle's gardening career.
You bet. Here's a couple of options. And I was a small space gardener for 26 years in a small city lot. But I did have space, and I also lived in apartments. So balconies and stairs, often a good option for containers, even the walk coming up to the apartment. Now, you may need to talk to the building manager, you know, in case you're expanding beyond your personal balcony. But often, a lot of apartments will let residents garden in that communal space. The other thing is there are a lot of great gardeners out there that may be having back or knee issues, great knowledge, but maybe lack some physical ability to garden. And I know a lot of people that team up with some of their friends, neighbors, with a gardener with experience and space, and they have the strong back and the will and ability, and it makes a great partnership that you have space to garden. They can, you share the produce, maybe they can help you weed or they share their advice, and it's a great way to get some space. Containers are excellent. Indoors is a little more challenging when you're doing food crops, but there's wonderful indoor container plants. Flowering plants, we talked about the pineapple, the relative bromeliad, easy to grow, anthurium, just a bright sunny window. So you can do indoor plants, herbs in the windowsill. Even leafy crops like lettuce and spinach, you could start some of those right now in a windowsill garden, and you'll get some greens that you can enjoy throughout these last few gray days, hopefully last few gray days, maybe last few months of gray.
You're very optimistic, Melinda.
I am, maybe delirious. So don't give up. Just be creative. Talk to your gardening friends. I bet they can help you come up with some space or cuttings that you can start some plants to grow indoors.
I love that idea of teaming up with someone who might have the knowledge and experience, but not necessarily the physical ability to do all the work themselves. It's really like kind of being an apprentice or having a mentor.
It is. And a lot of them have great gardens, wonderful soil. So, you know, you benefit from their years of gardening. And, you know, one of the things I love about what I do is gardeners are the nicest people in the world. They share their produce. They share their knowledge. And this is a great way to take advantage. You know, the longer you garden, the wiser you become about gardening, more seasons under your belt. Well, working with an experienced gardener is a great way to take advantage of what they've learned along the way.
That's a great idea. Let's go back to the phones and Julia in Milwaukee. Hi, Julia.
Hi. Your expert's very, very good. I listened to her a long time, but I was kind of shocked to hear her say that milorganite can be used on plants that you are going to be eating from, you know, vegetables and fruits.
And yeah,
heard that it had heavy metals in it from all the plating plants and other things in the Milwaukee area, and that they could not remove that the milorganite.
Okay, let's see what Melinda has to say.
Yeah, thank you, Julia, for bringing that up. That was about 30 years ago. Milorganite voluntarily took edible crops off of the bag label, and they cleaned up, which I'm glad because I drank Milwaukee water for years, they cleaned up the source so that is no longer an issue. Probably about 25 years ago, they put edibles back on the label. So I'm really glad you brought that up, Julia. They test daily and weekly for heavy metals. They look for safety. One of the nice things, Morganite being partially it's a byproduct of our wastewater treatment, so they're testing for safety and health issues come first and foremost. So I'm glad you brought that up, Julia. It is something that was an issue 30-some years ago. They cleaned up the problem, so edibles are back on the list. You know, that's one of the joys of gardening is you get to pick and choose what you put on your soil, what you put on your plants. So I'm comfortable using it. They test it, but, you know, that's something you need to be comfortable with, too. But it is back on the label. They test regularly. So I'm glad you brought that up, Julia.
It's really good. Yeah, thank you, Julia, for joining in. It's really good to get that kind of follow-up like you just gave us, Melinda, because so often we hear something like that in the news and then we never hear that maybe it was resolved or addressed. And as you said, now they not only addressed it at that one point, but they're really monitoring it well. So thank you very much for bringing that up, Julia. Let's go next to Mike in Kenosha. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Last year I had some clippings of prickly pear cactus that I got and tried planting them outside, and each one of them turned black and kind of rotted, and I didn't get any of them to actually take. And I understand they can be grown outside, and from what I understand, they're actually native to Wisconsin. But how can I have a little bit more success if I try again this year?
You know, great question. Prickly pear cactus are native in 48 of the 50 United States. But good drainage is key. So with heavier soils that we tend to have in parts of Kenosha as well as Milwaukee and many of the southeastern parts of Wisconsin, good drainage is critical. So adding lots of compost, using a raised bed. Some of the hardy cacti and succulent growers in Wisconsin actually create raised beds with very artificial soils, so they're not even dealing with the existing soils, but creating a very gritty growing system for those cacti and succulents. So look for a really sunny area. Consider raising that bed, if nothing else, amending it for good drainage, and I think you'll see some better results. You also may want to start with plants or root the cuttings in a container first. You know, let them, what we call suberize. They kind of callus over overnight or for a day or two. Then stick them in a well-drained potting mix or cactus mix, and then once rooted, then put them out because I think you can control the environment better when they're in a pot. So I would try that, too. For people interested, the Hardy Cacti and Succulent Group usually is around the Wisconsin State Fair, have a demonstration garden. Hmm. I think they still do in the DNR area. Used to be right by the Master Gardener Display Garden in the DNR portion of the Wisconsin State Fair. So if you're really interested, there are a few other things you can grow. It's just a fun group, really nice people, and, you know, they're the experts. They're the ones that have been pushing the limits, so they can definitely give you a hand.
I have to say, the first time I saw a prickly pear cactus growing in Wisconsin, I felt like I had suddenly been transported somewhere else without knowing it.
You know, I used to, when I taught at MATC, I had a slide from the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, and there's a great planting with yuccas, prickly pear cactus, gravel mulch. They have a couple boulders, and I'd always show the picture and say, where do you think this was taken? And everybody would guess Arizona. Minnesota usually did not come up on the list of guesses.
Wow. Well, and what is it about prickly pears that obviously, you know, we don't drive on Wisconsin highways and see other cacti like saguaros or anything. What is it about prickly pears that make them suitable for Wisconsin?
You know, I don't know what the hardiness issue is, but there's a great guy named Dr. David Franco, and I think his last name is spelled F-R-A-N, I think it's K-O or it might be C-K-O. And he wrote a book called Palms Won't Grow Here. And he was growing palmettos, fiber bananas, Confederate jasmine, and a variety of plants in Dayton, Ohio, at the University of Miami in Dayton, Ohio, not Florida. And he had a system of overwintering, but he was studying hardiness gene, what made some plants hardy, trying to introduce that. And so I don't know. Now I have a homework assignment, Judith.
We always like to send you off with a project.
It's always good.
Well, thanks for that call, Mike. And Mimi in Delafield is up next. Hi, Mimi.
Hi. I was wondering if ash from a burning pile would be beneficial or harmful. if you were to spread it out into your garden or use it in a compost or something like that.
So from just from like a, not from a like a charcoal grill necessarily, but from like a fire pit?
Exactly.
Okay.
From a fire pit.
You know, great question. Definitely the wood ash, here's the good and the bad. The wood ash doesn't really improve drainage. It's not a product that improves drainage. Putting it in your compost pile would be okay. It tends to be alkaline, so the ash tends to have a high pH. For those of us, Delafield, southern Wisconsin, our soil pHs tend to be high or sweet. So adding more to the soil to make it sweeter doesn't really help. It can be harmful. So I wouldn't add it directly to the garden here and for any place where we have high pH soils. If you're in central and northern Wisconsin where the soils are more acidic, you know, that's going to be fine. In the compost pile, the action of composting tends to be acidic or sour. So adding that will help kind of moderate both extremes of the alkalinity of the ash and the acidity of the compost. So if you want to recycle it, I'd throw it in the compost bin. I wouldn't put it on your garden in Delafield. And the benefits are very minimal to none because of the fine material. So it's just a way of reusing it versus tossing it out. So you could even put it in a pathway, maybe under mulch or something like that, if you just are looking for a little more environmentally friendly way of disposing of it.
Now, when Mimi asked her question, I asked whether she meant from a charcoal grill or not. And we often do get those questions of whether the ash that falls through a charcoal grill onto that little, you know, kind of plate underneath, if that's something that can or should be added to compost or to gardens. And what would you say about that, Melinda?
I would probably err on the side of being careful and not. Depending on, you know, is it soaked in, you know, any lighter fluid? Is it truly charcoal? I guess I'd be a little concerned about not knowing exactly what's in those charcoal briquettes and making sure it's okay. So I was glad you asked that question. If you know the source, it's wood, it hasn't had any preservatives, which you wouldn't want to be burning anyway at a fire pit, then that's a much safer option. So I guess I would err on the side of, you know, find a better use that's not going to be impacting plants, mm-hmm. water quality, things like that.
Thanks for that call, Mimi. And let's go next to Brooke in Eau Claire. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, I'm getting over a cold, so excuse me. But
no problem.
I'm a big believer in mulching, and they always say in winter, don't leave a garden, the soil, bare. But I came across a couple Ruth Stout books a couple years ago, and she left that mulch on year-round. Well, what I found out the last couple of years when I got ready to plant in the spring, everything was full of like what looked like mouse runs underneath that mulch, so is that not such a good idea, or should it be removed in the fall? So
you know, I really appreciate the question because I started my career, I think, about the time Ruth's books first came out and had an interesting opportunity. Never got to chat with her, but gardeners who were adopting it. Besides creating a great environment for voles, that's who's running underneath there eating seeds and things, and if there's no plants in there, then that's probably okay, but then they might be running out and munching on your shrubs and munching on your trees and that type of thing. My other concern is our soils, our springs can be very cool and wet, and mulch soils tend to stay cool and moist and are slow to warm up. So that is another downside. So it's kind of a trade-off. You leave the mulch on, you protect the soil from erosion. I like to use shredded leaves around my perennials and things on the soil, not on the plants. I find that is, you know, voles may be an issue, but not as bad as tall grass or thicker layers of straw mulch and things like that. And with perennials, they're in the ground, they're rooted. So if I'm slowing up spring, it's not the problem of my vegetable garden where I'm hoping to get an early start. So there's some great debate, and you'll find people that I'm a turn over the organic matter in the fall. A rough plow, if it's not subject to erosion, the organic matter breaks down, it's ready to plant. There are others that go with the mulching technique, and it's kind of, neither one is bad, it's just different results, and I think a lot of it's habit. You know, my dad raised me, you spade a garden, you know, I used a shovel, not on my big garden now, but in my little gardens would always use the shovel, always till in, dig in leaves in the fall because that just improved the soil. and by spring they were broken down, the soil was ready to plant. So you're right, there's downsides on both. So it's kind of seeing what fits into your gardening style the best.
Thanks for that call. And just to follow up on an earlier point that was made, we and one of our callers, I believe up in Rhinelander, was talking about straw bale gardening. And yeah. I think it was Jerry up in Rhinelander had 35 bales going, which is really impressive. And we had a listener who wanted to know where they could find more information on that. And the best place to start is Joel Karsten's website. It's Straw Bale Gardens, so straw and then B-A-L-E. gardens.com, and it has lots of information there, and then there's also the book that he wrote, and there are videos, and basically it's a technique where you condition a straw bale to be your, it turns into your garden medium, your planting medium, and according to what we've heard, people have really great success with it.
And it elevates your garden, so it's up above. You do need to condition it so that it starts to turn into compost to feed your plants, but yes, he's done a great job of getting the word out. This technique's been around for hundreds of years, but I think he's put it in a format that's easy to follow, easy to use, and fun. So it's, you know, you may not want to start with 35. Jerry, good job. You know, you may want to start on a smaller scale. I think Larry said he did one.
Yes, Larry did one.
Larry did one. So, you know, if you're a little nervous or tentative, that's a good way. I know you do tons of container gardens.
I do.
A patio. And I think there's always ways to garden if you want. And you know, if something's brand new to you, start small. You can always add more later. When you start too big, sometimes you get frustrated and overwhelmed, and then you quit too soon. So it sounds like that wasn't an issue for Jerry, but, you know, you might want to start a little smaller if it's a new technique for you.
And the great thing about the straw bales is you can place them wherever you have the best sun, and, you know, you're not having to kind of shoehorn a garden in where there's not really room for you. Just plop it on the top in the best place and you're good to go.
You bet. And that's one of the things I'm doing with my edible garden, learning garden photography. I'm going to do some lasagna gardening. I'm going to do some straw bale gardening. I'm going to show different techniques because I have gravelly, rocky soil at my new home and I'm anxious to get good results quickly. So I'll do long-term soil preparation and conditioning, but these are some things that can jumpstart your garden, too. Mm-hmm. So not only convenient for sun, but if your soil's not too good, it's a great way to work around that. Instead of, you know, soil improvement's important, but it does take time. This is a way to kind of jumpstart things.
Well, and for people that want to learn more about those different techniques that you just mentioned, we've done shows on Garden Talk on many of those. So going to WPR.org, and if you search for straw bale or Karsten, it's K-A-R-S-T-E-N. We did a whole Garden Talk show with Joel Karsten. You can learn more about that. And we've talked with Roger Reynolds about lasagna gardening. And so there's a lot of great information there at WPR.org. You can go back and listen to any of those shows, including this one. Melinda, you shared so much great information with us today.
Well, thank you, Judith. It's always a pleasure, and I always love chatting with your listeners as well.
And I know we will have you back at the end of February, and we'll be talking about, you have a couple new publications out.
You bet. It's always the fun part of writing books is when you get to talk about them to gardeners and share gardening information. The writing at the computer, not so fun, but the aftermath, a lot more fun.
Well, Melinda Myers is a Milwaukee-based garden expert, the author of more than 20 gardening books, and she's also the host of Melinda's Garden Moments. Melinda, thanks so much for spending this chilly day with us on the radio.
Thanks, Judith. Have a great weekend.
You too. And this is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next Friday on Garden Talk, Dan Marr will be here to talk about growing succulents. It's a passion of his, and we always love to have him on to talk about those, that fascinating family of plants. Coming up Monday, Peter Green of Infostar.com is here with advice for what to do when you experience the dreaded blue screen crash on your computer using Windows. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network.